And now let's go to Egypt, where the euphoria of revolution has given way to the dismay of unemployment. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
It's a Friday afternoon in May in Tahrir Square, and complaints and advice are pouring from loudspeakers as Egyptians try to revive the momentum of their January revolution. But just off the square, it's easy to see how devastating the Arab Spring has been to economies in the Mideast and North Africa. And nowhere has the damage been greater than here in Egypt. Just ask Abu Saud Mustafa, a slender 50-year-old standing on the street holding a stack of papyrus sheets featuring drawings of Egypt's ancient pharaohs. They used to sell for the equivalent of $10 or $15 apiece. But now, if he can find a tourist to buy one, the best he can get is $2 or $3. For him, desperation has become the norm.
Ever since the revolution, there's been no work. I have three kids, and I can't even provide enough food for them. The government has to do something. We need stability and safety so the tourists come back. This is vital to us, the poor people who depend on a day's work so we can eat.
The forecast does not look promising. Predictions of 7% growth have been slashed. Tourists who fled in droves at the peak of the season have been slow to return. Inflation in March jumped to more than 11%, and in the first quarter, Egypt's stock market lost nearly a quarter of its value. Egypt's military rulers have not been shy about broadcasting the bad news. One said foreign investment in Egypt was near zero, and another said if things don't change, more than two-thirds of the population could wind up in poverty in the short term. Economist Ahmed El-Nagar at the Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies says in its desperate effort to crush the rebellion, the Mubarak regime further poisoned the economic atmosphere by blaming foreigners for the unrest and releasing prisoners onto the streets.
And they freed about 23,000 criminals against the society. They pushed them to fight against the society, and this affects the tourism sector, finance sector, and also foreign and internal trade.
The interim government is taking a few steps, boosting the minimum wage and imposing a 10% capital gains tax. But the private sector near-term outlook is gloomy, with hundreds of top businessmen reportedly hiding in Europe, afraid of being caught in the anti-corruption backlash now underway. Economist John Safakianakis with the Saudi Francie Bank in Riyadh told Al Jazeera's English channel as Egypt's revolution unfolded that the country's economic problems go back well before anything the Mubarak government did or failed to do.
In many ways, they go back to the 1950s when the industry was nationalized. In many ways, the entrepreneurial class of Egypt was destroyed since the 50s. The middle class in Egypt shrunk over the last 10 years exponentially. So as a result, today you have a system where it is semi-capitalist and semi-socialist.
There are other tensions to worry about as well. In downtown Cairo, Fatih Said sits in the souvenir shop opened by his grandfather in 1928. A Coptic Christian, Said says he's naturally optimistic. He thinks Egypt has weathered worse economic storms than this. But he fears a resurgence of the kind of Muslim-Christian violence that led to torched churches in the Imbaba neighborhood earlier this year.
After what's happening in Imbaba, the curve is going down also. If it's not, nothing happens like that, I think it will be good. If the security is okay, everything will be very, very good.
Economist Ahmed El-Nagar also has a positive outlook in the longer term. He points out that Egypt probably won't fare as badly as other countries that have undergone similar upheavals.
Because in transition period in Russia, there was minus 10% for GDP annually for 6 years.
Such thoughts may not reassure Egyptians struggling to make ends meet each day. But their calls for greater security, while getting a sympathetic ear among Egypt's ruling military council, are raising alarm bells among the young Egyptians who sparked this revolution. They worry that the military will use these calls for stability to postpone real reforms, perhaps indefinitely. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
The current economy with a high unemployment rate is among the reasons more Americans seem to be asking, is a college degree really worth it? Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's spent a career thinking about the value of a college education. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
So recognizing the answer might be complicated, why should students and their families go into hock for hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a job that might pay less than what they paid for tuition?
Well, you know, I think maybe the place to start is with the hundreds of thousands of dollars part. You know, it's unfortunate that we set our sights on the top 20, 30 universities in the United States when we think about going to college. And by top, I mean the ones that get the highest rankings in U.S. News and World Report, the ones that have the most cachet. But there are thousands upon thousands of other institutions of higher learning, public institutions of higher learning, where it costs a whole lot less and where you can get a decent education. And unfortunately, I think people are kind of guided away from them because they're quote-unquote low status. They're not going to lead anywhere, but it's just not true.
There are undoubtedly benefits other than vocational to a college education, but I'm wondering if it's harder in a time like this to get people to focus on that.
I mean, you know, we respond to the threat that's most imminent, right? I mean, that's the way we survive. It's part of human nature. So it makes complete sense that when we listen to public policy spokespeople, when we listen to our legislators, that virtually the only reason we hear to get an education is an economic one. You know, we need to prepare students for the 21st century economy, and we need to educate our citizenry so that we can regain the kind of economic preeminence that we held for so long. All of that is understandable. What concerns me, Scott, is that it can also narrow our vision. If all we talk about, as we've been doing for decades now, is the economic payoff of education, that ends up affecting finally what we teach and how we teach it. Hmm. It ends up affecting the way we define what it means to be educated.
Well, and remind us of some of those benefits.
You know, historically, there's been many other justifications for education in our country that, in fact, have trumped the economic one. I mean, for many, many years, the civic and moral purpose of mass education was trumpeted. Mm-hmm. You know, the Jeffersonian ideal, right? That to have a functioning democracy, you need an educated citizenry. So that kind of civic purpose of education has certainly been important. The idea of intellectual growth, that is, not just learning things to make a living, but also learning things to enable you to do things with your life, to enable you to find interests and pursuits that in some way or another maybe, you know, expand the way you see things. There's a social benefit to it, for sure. Learning to think together, learning to attack problems together, learning how to disagree, being exposed to other points of view. So there's these kind of multiple reasons that historically have played in and out of our justifications for schooling.
Is it harder, though, to get people to cherish the value of the Jeffersonian ideal when they're working as a barista?
That's a really good point. But maybe that's exactly the time when they should be thinking about the Jeffersonian ideal. That is, the kind of education that would enable you to think about the politics and economics that have you working in a Starbucks. You know, to be able to think about our economic situation in some kind of an analytical and sophisticated way is not something that comes easy, and I think it does come with study.
What's the effect of students being able to look at people like Bill Gates and Jeff Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs? And they're pretty prominent college dropouts who will say college was just not meeting my needs. And they can finish that sentence by saying, and now I'm one of the most successful people in the world.
I am absolutely not a person who says one size fits all. In arguing for some kind of education beyond high school, I'm not just talking about the regular four-year liberal arts degree. I mean, I think a lot of remarkable stuff happens in occupational programs, in two-year college programs. You know, the Bill Gateses, the Zuckerbergs. They're rare, and I think we have to be careful about generalizing from rare examples.
Is college still valuable for giving students a space to experiment?
Some of the students I work with in a poor urban community college right now, boy, they don't have time to experiment, right? I mean, they are desperately trying to build the skills to be able to get a better toehold on the economy. So let's first admit that the good fortune to be able to experiment isn't available to everybody just in terms of, you know, your income background. But that notion of college as being a place to try things on makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I see it So often, young people come in, they have an idea for a major, and then they take that astronomy class, or they take that history class, or they take that literature class, or a dance class, and boom, a light goes on for them, and they find a passion.
Mike Rose, a professor of education at UCLA, author of several books about education, including The Mind at Work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Job growth is slowing, and President Obama's poll numbers are slipping. So the White House is trying to stage an intervention. All week long, the administration took pains to show the economy remains the president's top concern, that he's doing everything possible to try to bring it back. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
One morning this week, the White House gave the press corps about 10 minutes warning that members of the cabinet would be coming out to speak on the White House driveway. Only three reporters made it in time. Construction rumbled in the background as four senior officials stepped up to the microphones. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack described the new council to help Americans living in rural communities.
What they want to see more of are empty storefronts filled with jobs. So this is a council that's going to focus on figuring out ways to provide more investment in rural America so that we can create jobs and economic growth.
If you missed the subtext there, President Obama was even blunter at a news conference on Tuesday.
As long as there are some folks out there who are unemployed looking for work, then every morning when I wake up, I'm going to be thinking about how we can get them back to work.
The White House is playing an inside game and an outside game on the economy. The inside game is about policies, things that might actually address the problem. The outside game is about communications, convincing the American people that this president is doing everything he can to fix the problem. At that Tuesday news conference, the president pushed the outside game hard, and he gave a glimpse of the inside game, too.
One of the things that I'm going to be interested in exploring with the members of both parties in Congress is how do we continue some of these policies to make sure that we get this recovery up and running in a robust way.
This is a question the White House has asked from day one. What else can we do? From the Recovery Act to tax cuts to research and development tax credits, this president has pushed a litany of programs in an effort to bring back the economy. And month by month, things were incrementally getting better. This White House never misses an opportunity to say that 2 million new jobs have been created since this president took office. But then came the latest jobs report.
There's just not enough work out there. The latest unemployment numbers show an economy stuck in first gear.
The inside game on policy seemed to be faltering, and the outside game on communications followed. A Washington Post ABC News poll showed that more Americans than ever disapprove of President Obama's handling of the economy. For Republicans, it's evidence that Democrats have taken the wrong approach from day one.
We are facing a cliff that this president is taking us off of.
Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus spoke at a Bloomberg breakfast on Wednesday.
I don't know if throwing more money at the problem is going to solve anything. I mean, we need a president that actually focuses in on creating jobs as opposed to making it harder. And unfortunately, on his watch, things have gotten much worse.
Clearly, there are Republicans who have an interest in having a weak economy for the next election. It will certainly help them.
Liberal economist Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research thinks this White House deserves blame for doing too little spending.
There's not much disagreement among economists that the stimulus did save some jobs. The problem is that we lost a lot more than that. So the main problem with the stimulus from an economic policy point of view is it just wasn't large enough.
In the view of these economists, the kind of budget cuts being negotiated right now as a price for raising the debt ceiling could cause still more jobs to be lost. And that would be one more headache for the president, even as he tries to focus on the nearly 14 million Americans still looking for a job. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
A big reason the U.S. delegation is on a trade mission in Zambia is China. The world's other economic superpower has fanned out across the African continent in the past decade, building roads, drilling wells, and mining minerals. In the long history of foreign influence in Africa, China is the newest and most visible presence. Frank Langfitt, NPR's East Africa correspondent, joins us from Nairobi. So are the Chinese interested in Africa for pretty much the same reasons Europe and America have been?
In many ways. Of course, now it's really especially about natural resources and has been for quite a number of years. Oil in Nigeria, copper down there in Zambia, even more oil in Sudan. And what they're looking for is because their economy is growing so fast, they need more steel for the skyscrapers in Shanghai, oil for the gas tanks of all those cars that keep coming on the roads in Beijing. But the Chinese are also looking for new markets here in Africa for their industrial engine. Here's another power project that's kind of interesting that was just mentioned in Beijing. They want to build a lot of solar panel projects in 40 African nations, and that creates more demand for their own manufacturing. Right here in Kenya, a new truck plant is coming. They're laying fiber optic cable. And a lot of the fastest growing economies right now are actually in Africa.
And as you travel across Africa, how visible is the Chinese presence?
Very. I'll give you an example. When I first flew into Kampala, the Ugandan capital, I got on a Chinese-made bus at the airport and immediately passed signs for Chinese restaurant, Chinese hotel. I was just in Nigeria, and you could hear Mandarin in the airport. And of course, 10 years ago, all this kind of involvement would be unthinkable.
And how are Africans responding to seeing a growing Chinese presence?
Well, it really depends on the country. You hear this, and it's a little bit of a cliche to say, oh, they're the new colonizers. But other people look at them and say they're a boon to some of these less developed countries. Kenya, I think the feelings are more positive than in some places. They're building a lot of roads in a country that really needs them. The airport is decrepit, and they're fixing that up. They're rebuilding a stadium. They're also looking to build a deep water port to also help get oil out of South Sudan. But generally here in Kenya, I think it's more positive than some places. Now, Zambia, there's a lot more tension, especially about labor issues. Back last fall, there were a couple of Chinese managers who actually shot 13 mine workers during a protest. And Zambians have been very critical about working conditions in Chinese companies there. And it's become even a political issue. The opposition presidential candidate has run in the past on an anti-China platform.
What kind of interaction is there between Chinese, some people, laborers, some people, company representatives, perhaps even some tourists, and Africans on a personal level?
Not as much as you might expect. I mean, one is there is a big language barrier. Also, a lot of Chinese companies actually import labor here. They live in camps, so they have little contact with Africans. They eat their meals there. They get most of the things that they buy there. And there are also big social differences. Chinese, as you know, you've been a fair bit of time in China. You go to Beijing and Shanghai, they're very friendly in their own culture. But when they go overseas, yeah, they're sometimes shyer, keep more to themselves. Of course, many Africans are really warm and outgoing to strangers. There's a Gallup poll last year that was kind of interesting. 40% of Africans said that there were too many Chinese here on the continent, and only 16% said that there were too many Americans.
And does China's expansion into Africa in any way threaten, curtail, affect U.S. and Western interests there?
Well, the U.S. is still the most important presence in many of these countries because it still is by far the largest economy in the world. But it's really clear China's gaining a lot of ground. And some African politicians really like the way the Chinese operate. The companies work really fast, often do a better job than the African firms. And Chinese government doesn't ask questions about human rights or politics. You got to remember the Chinese have supported Omar al-Bashir. He's the indicted war criminal and president of Sudan. They've also here in Kenya been supportive of the Kenyan government, some of the politicians not wanting to be held accountable for election violence a few years ago. So when you look at many African leaders, some of them really prefer this kind of no-strings-attached model. They find it pretty attractive.
NPR East Africa correspondent Frank Langfitt, speaking from Nairobi. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Scott.